live from Cap Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Cap Radio's politics reporter, Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White today. Homophobic, misogynist, racist, rude, crude, crass. Just a few of the things people called Rush Limbaugh over the decades. He, on the other hand, called himself a truth detector, doctor of democracy, lover of mankind. Limbaugh died yesterday of lung cancer. He was 70 years old, and he might go down in history as quite possibly the most controversial person on the airwaves ever. Rush Limbaugh had the largest radio audience in the 90s, with over 20 million listeners tuning into his three-hour-long show. But the conservative radio host got his start right here in Sacramento in 1984 at KFBK, where the marketing department had some fun at his expense. Billboards read, "Don't you want to punch Rush Limbaugh?" A nod to his over-the-top antics and sharp commentary on the air. His show became nationally syndicated and was moved to New York in 1988. Limbaugh spoke with KCRA on his last day in Sacramento and mentioned it was bittersweet to leave.
This is the kind of thing that you dream of happening. But then it's bittersweet, too, because I'm really not sure I want to leave.
Even though he left Sacramento more than three decades ago, Limbaugh still had an affinity for poking fun at our area, especially the town of Rio Linda. This was Limbaugh just last February.
And in the bites that we have here, Trump deals with the Democrats and the coronavirus, goes after Justice Sotomayor, for those of you in Rio Linda. And he really has gone after these two judges on the Supreme Court. This is coronavirus 19. The official name of it is Code V-19. But it's in common parlance, so that even people of Rio Linda can follow along. It's coronavirus number 19.
As a radio host at KFBK Sacramento in the early 80s, one of Limbaugh's call screeners was Kitty O'Neill. She is still at KFBK and is now an afternoon news anchor. She stayed friends with Limbaugh after his departure from Sacramento. Cap Radio's Mike Haggerty spoke with her yesterday about the time she spent working with him and how they continued their friendship as his fame grew.
Some people, maybe a lot of people, don't know is that your first job at KFBK was as a, what's the term, call screener, producer? Rush Limbaugh.
That is correct.
Take me back to the beginning. What were you doing the day before Rush Limbaugh?
Well, actually, I worked at KFBK on a part-time temporary basis for a few months, and I was call screening for Morton Downey Jr. In fact, I took the call from City Councilman Tom Chin that resulted in the firing of Morton Downey Jr. When he was gone, my time at that station, because it was temporary at that time, went away. I was filling in for somebody that was ill. I was brought back in 85, and lo and behold, there was Rush Limbaugh. And I worked with him for about 3 years, call screening, producing in that capacity.
Now, Morton Downey Jr. obviously was a very controversial person, maybe even more so after KFBK. But still, he was wild enough to get himself fired. You obviously were no stranger to controversial talk hosts, but did that prepare you for Rush Limbaugh?
Not really. I mean, I was pretty young, and this was my first job, and I thought it was kind of a lot of over-the-top silliness, to be honest with you. Especially with Morton Downey Jr. But then when Rush came on, it was, it's hard to say, but maybe even a little better natured, but still I thought he was pretty goofy. And he had all these ideas that were conservative ideas, but yet he was presenting them like the way a morning FM radio jock would present them with, you know, music and bits and production. And he was more of an entertainer at that point in time.
Is it fair to say that the act changed after he went national, that it became more serious political?
No doubt about it. He was pretty wacky when he was at KFBK. And I remember talking to people who even were moderates to, you know, leaning more left, who just found him kind of entertaining and funny. But then, yeah, his whole course changed when he left Sacramento. Not to say he didn't take on political topics in town. He did. He used to debate the mayor of Davis, I remember, in scheduled debates. But it was more lighthearted, I would say, back then.
And there was, as you say, kind of the divide among the audience at that point, it sounds like. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but there were people who listened for the entertainment value, and there were people who were saying, hey, I agree with this guy on whatever topic.
Yes, or I totally disagree with this guy, and how dare you let him say these things on the air? Yeah, it was everything. He had, I think, a pretty wide base, which is why he was so popular. And people did tune in just to hear what he would say, because he was so outrageous. And I think that over time, he got into that very serious political track. But when he started out, it was more of an entertainment show laced with politics.
Was there a time when he was at KFBK where you kind of sat there and looked through the glass and said, oh, man, you have just gone way too far?
A number of times, yeah. He reminded me a little bit of an older time comedian. Younger people might not know who he was, but Don Rickles was a comedian back then, and he kind of had that insult comedy. And I think there was an element of that in what he was doing. But he had his own spin on it. As I said, he would incorporate music and bits and things like that. So he kind of made it his own.
Since you bring up Don Rickles and insults, there's no secret, as you look at the messages about Rush Limbaugh's passing today, that there are people who consider him racist, sexist, misogynist, a spreader of false information. At the time, did he appear to be those things to you while he was working as a local talk show host in Sacramento?
Not to the extent that he is considered to be so now by many people. And, I have friends on both sides, people who think he was the best thing that ever happened in radio, to people who think he did irreparable damage to the country. So, you know, I get it. I've heard it all. But at that time, Mike, he hadn't even registered to vote when he was in Sacramento doing
really?
The show. Yeah. And I thought, oh, no, when this gets out, his career's over. This is it for him. No one's going to take him seriously. But didn't seem to have an impact. The news got out and he just carried on and things carried on. But it indicated that this guy's an entertainer. You know, if he was serious, he would have registered right off the bat. And he had some reason. Well, you know, I moved here and I missed a deadline or some such thing, you know. But his whole thing changed over the course of time, as, you know, many people in their radio careers do, alter what they do. But he did.
Full disclosure, you and I have known each other for 7 years. We worked together for 6 of those years. We anchored the afternoon news together for 3 of those years. I know you very well. I know you to be a very sweet, very kind person who would rather suffer any indignity than cause someone else an indignity. So how did you maintain a friendship, even in the years after he left KFBK, with Rush Limbaugh?
You know, I guess it was compartmentalizing. I really never, to be honest, I rarely listened to his show. I really didn't know half of the things he was saying. And I hate to admit that, but it's true. I had my own life, I had my own show. I was busy. I didn't sit and listen, you know, to mm-hmm. talk radio. I was busy doing radio. But on a personal level, he was always very kind to me, very generous. And I could see how he treated other people of different viewpoints and persuasions. When he was with them in person, he wasn't insulting, he wasn't unkind. And I thought, is this just, you know, is he just following some kind of persona on the air? I mean, does he not really feel like this? But then I think he must have. I mean, how could you manufacture that for so many years? So I don't know, Mike. conflicted about it, really. I could just tell you on a personal level, he was always very kind to me, but I took issue with things that he would say on there, and I'd look at him and like, what, why are you even saying that? I don't get how you could arrive at that conclusion, but you know, I guess I just made a separation.
Okay. And as what I'm hearing there is that there was the on rush and the off rush, that the man on the radio did not square. And I know at least one other person who was close to Rush Limbaugh, that the person on the air did not square with the person off the air.
That's how I feel. Although I was listening to Tom Sullivan, a mutual friend of ours, who knew Rush really well, who said Rush believed everything that he said on the air. And I...
That was going to be my next question to you, was whether you thought Rush believed what he said.
Well, maybe later. I didn't feel like he did when I worked with him. I thought it was entertainment and, you know, pranking people practically. I never felt like this is who he really was.
So here's the tough question. A lot of people say that our fractured political discourse, the hostility, the anger, the shouting, the talking over each other, and the misinformation lands squarely, or at least a good portion of it, in Rush Limbaugh's lap. Do you agree with that? And if so, do you believe that's fair and he earned it?
It's a fine line I have to walk.
Yeah.
And I have heard it from both sides, from people very dear to me who think he is responsible for a lot of what is wrong in this country now. And I also have people who think he was a godsend and how much we needed him and how much he'll be missed. You know, Mike, I always try to stay apolitical, mm-hmm. But I can look at it and I can say yes. And then others, I can hear what they would say, who would disagree. And I'm talking in circles because it's very hard for me to answer that question.
Of course. So last question. How will you remember him? Is this going to be the continuation of your compartmentalizing Rush Limbaugh?
You know, I remember what he was to me personally and how he treated me as a person. But I know that he was very disruptive to others in terms of how they felt, and I would get calls from people who were very upset, even back then, who didn't understand why somebody like this could even be on the radio. How could we possibly allow it? And so he's always been an agitator and polarizing, and it's just what he did. But he had enough, obviously, of a base that catapulted him to one of the biggest radio stars we've ever known. But I guess for me, I just have to think of, you know, how he was for me personally, but it's hard because I know there's people who feel he did tremendous damage as well.
That was CAP Radio Afternoon anchor Mike Haggerty in conversation with KFBK's Kitty O'Neill about her working and personal friendship with the late Rush Limbaugh. Up next, from shock radio to Fox News and a host of other outlets, Limbaugh may be off the air, but he gave life to conservative talk. Up next, his impact on political discourse, identity, and tribalization, and the pants on fire rating for a viral tweet about California's recall process. Shoot us an email to insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon, filling in today for Randall White. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Cap Radio's politics reporter, Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White today. Rush Limbaugh's impact on politics will be studied by political scientists for years to come. His influence has been felt for decades, even to the very end in this last election. And he helped perpetuate the notion that the election was stolen. Joining us to discuss Rush Limbaugh's impact is Sacramento State political science professor Dr. Kim Naller. She is also the director of the Project for an Informed Electorate. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Naller, you teach a course at Sac State called Mass Media and American Politics. In your textbook, if there was a chapter on Rush Limbaugh, what would that chapter be titled?
There actually is a lot of political science on Rush Limbaugh himself, but, you know, I mean, he's a pioneer in right-wing talk radio and also a pioneer in, grievance radio as entertainment.
Well, why do you think he was so successful in that?
You know, I think he really proved that there was an audience that was ready to engage in politics that probably, you know, previous to his show and shows like it, although his was one of the very first, didn't pay a ton of attention to politics. It might have been sort of, you know, an occasional thing. But once a show like that comes on the air and he's entertaining, and as we just heard, you know, he could be fun and funny, then people start to make that part of their daily lives. You know, there are many people for decades who listened to him as they commuted or listened to them as they went about their work day, listened to him as they drove their kids to school. And that became sort of a part of the fabric of their lives and probably politicized those people in a way that they wouldn't have been before, and in a particular right-wing way.
Well, why do you think then that conservative media has blossomed so much over the years? I mean, we hear that he was a pioneer for this type of radio. Why did it take off with him?
Well, I think there's a real hunger for someone who shares your grievances. And I think it's actually interactive. It's not the case necessarily that people had the same grievances and then listened to him. It kind of goes back and forth. He projects those grievances and people take those on. In media studies and public opinion studies, we see that in many cases, the opinions that people have are led by media figures or opinion leaders like him. So I think in many cases, he's the one who planted ideas in people's minds. But it also goes the other direction in that, you know, people are in certain demographic groups, you know, he really appealed to middle-aged to older white men in particular, and who may have had the same sort of outgroup feelings towards the same outgroups, and that was very motivating. They felt like they were part of a team, part of an insider group, listening to him. That he was someone who showed that they mattered and that their points of view were validated.
Well, why do you think so many people believed every single word that Limbaugh said? He got his start, you know, as sort of a shock jock. Why did people believe all of this? Like the birther argument that President Obama wasn't even born in the United States.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, he also pushed the, you know, the death panels in the ACA when there was nothing of the sort in that, and the big lie around the election in 2020. People believe those things because they're, you know, I mean, in many cases, people believe things because they're looking for answers and they want to find confirmation that they are, and especially with conspiracy theories, it's this idea that you have knowledge that other people don't, that you are an insider. And it's also part of this kind of tribalism, right? That that we have teams. And I think that the fact that his show was largely entertainment, and it was one of the first to be like that infotainment, right? He's he's mixing entertainment and joking around and music with news commentary. And when you do that, it becomes very persuasive, but it also brings people into sort of the inside. And, you know, they're friends with him. A lot of people really feel like he's, you know, an uncle who just died or a good friend who just died. And when your uncle tells you things every day, you start to believe them. You know, I mean, it's just the repetition too. And he had a, you know, multi-hour show every day. And when he said those things over and over again, they felt very believable to his audience.
Well, outside of the influence and sort of the relationship with the everyman, you know, Limbaugh was not an elected official, but you could argue that he had more power than any, you know, elected official, any senator. Why did he have so much influence over his own party?
Well, he, you know, I think initially he was not as welcomed within the party when the party was more, you know, traditional and staid. But over time, I think there's this interactive effect that the party leadership or members of the party running for office realized that they could tap into his audience, that he had an incredibly popular show. He got great ratings, you know, across the entire country. And so if that constituency exists, why not cater to them? Why not start to speak their language? And if you can co-opt that portion of the population that's already bought into whatever he says, it's very useful. And so I think, you know, there's kind of this interaction between him and politicians. And I even think that Donald Trump may have modeled some of his behavior on Trump, on Rush Limbaugh, that Rush Limbaugh is actually the predecessor to the Trump style.
Well, do you think then that Limbaugh is partly or maybe even solely responsible for getting Donald Trump elected?
I think he laid the groundwork over many decades for that style of grievance and insult politics. And it became very normalized over, you know, several generations, really. I mean, it was decades that he was on the air. And if you were a kid who grew up listening to Rush Limbaugh because your dad listened to it when he drove you to school, you really internalized that message. And, you know, I would never say there was one thing that caused the election to go one way or the other, but he certainly laid the groundwork for that sort of confrontational style. And, you know, he did that thing where he referred it to the Democrat Party or Democrat politicians without the ick on the Democratic is the proper way we use it. Mm-hmm. But that caught on. They use it on Fox News. It was actually focus grouped because it sounds more like rat. It has a more negative sound to it. If you say Democrat instead of Democratic. And that became almost universal amongst right-wing commentators and also, you know, radio hosts and so forth. It just kind of shows how his influence, even on language, was very pervasive.
Yeah, he's also credited with coining the term feminazi, which is, you know, now known as this slur. Limbaugh used emotion to get what he wanted or to get his point across. Can you talk about that? Maybe give an example, if you can think of one, to explain why that was so effective.
Well, we know that emotions can rally people. And the emotion that it, well, two emotions that are really activated by his style are anger, right? So he's mocking, giving nicknames to, you know, all of that sort of making people angry about people, about folks on the left and about politics of the left, but also enthusiasm. So he kind of whips up the enthusiasm and motivates people to do things. So those emotions are very strong, but also very motivating. They activate people to do things. So that might be, you know, today it might be going on social media and spreading that message more and, you know, thereby increasing the impact. But it also might be voting and, tuning into a show again the next day, too.
How much blame do you put on Rush Limbaugh for where our country is today in terms of, you know, the current level of discourse and division and tribalization?
I do think that his brand of demonization is, you know, he laid the groundwork for that back in the 90s. This idea that, you know, we used to think of our political opponents not even necessarily as opponents, but just as, you know, fellow Americans who happen to have, you know, slightly different ideas about how we reach our goals, how we make the country better. But he started this trend of openly, publicly demonizing the other side, you know, calling them feminazis instead of, you know, just women who happen to have different opinions than me. And I think, you know, as you see it growing over the years, you can draw a straight line between what he started back in the 90s and continued over the decades to what happened on January 6th. The misinformation, the demonization, the idea that, you know, the QAnon conspiracy could be bought into by so many Americans really starts with the seeds planted by a show like Rush Limbaugh's.
Well, that just, you know, shows you have a lot of Republican officials calling for unity. But it's kind of shocking to hear you, you know, draw that direct line from things that Limbaugh was saying decades ago. After his death now, what do you think is the future of conservative media?
I think he opened Pandora's box. He's built this audience and this expectation. You know, we see it also, you know, Fox News opinion shows certainly emulate that style as well. There are many other right-wing talk radio hosts that do something similar. You know, interestingly, it doesn't work on the left as well. Like the left had Air America Network for a while. Rachel Maddow even had a show on that radio network, but it didn't take off. There's something about this grievance on the right that is especially resonant. I don't know that we can.
Why do you think that is? Why doesn't it work as well on the left? You know, people try to compare Fox and MSNBC, but it sounds like you're saying that they might not be, you know, totally opposites.
Yeah, I don't think they are. Certainly one's on the left and one's on the right. So there's that. And certainly there are opinion shows on each network. But, you know, frankly, the misinformation levels are not equal. The idea that, you know, President Obama wasn't born in the United States, you don't see something similar to that on the left. And just the core values are different. So, you know, the core values within conservatism have to do with hierarchy. So punching down kind of makes sense within a hierarchy. The primary value of liberalism is equality. And so the idea of, you know, punching up or down is, you know, runs contrary to those ideals. And then there's also just the sort of psychological aversion to disagreeableness that is more common amongst liberals than it is amongst conservatives. So there are more conservatives that enjoy kind of mixing things up and causing trouble and upsetting people. They find it entertaining. Not that there aren't people on the left that like that too, but it's disproportionate. Mm.
Sacramento State political science professor Dr. Kim Nalder, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The big political news in California remains the effort to recall Governor Gavin Newsom, as backers of the measure have hit the 1.5 million signature threshold. They continue to work to get more signatures as insurance, as they will need to verify those signatures. And this week, the recall effort gained attention across the country as the Republican National Committee donated $250,000 to the effort recently. But with that attention has also come misinformation. Cap Radio's PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols joins us now to talk about a fact check he wrote this week on that topic. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Nicole. Great to be here.
So, Chris, the claim you checked this week combined the recall effort, the November election, and a Hollywood actor. Tell us about it.
It combined a lot of things. That's right. So early this week, Kevin Sorbo, who starred in the Hercules TV series back in the 1990s, if you remember that, he's a vocal supporter of President Donald Trump. He posted what became a viral tweet. He claimed that California did not verify signatures on mail-in ballots during last fall's election, but that it will do so on the petitions to recall Governor Newsom. And normally we wouldn't look too closely at Kevin Sorbo's tweets, but this one was shared more than 30,000 times, including by some high-profile Republicans, everyone from former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee to Trump's former attorney Rudy Giuliani.
Okay, so widely shared. Give us the reality check then on verifying signatures on mail-in ballots, because wasn't that a big part of last fall's election?
It was. Election officials really made a point of highlighting this safeguard. They said it over and over and over again. Every mail-in ballot had to have a signature on the outside of the ballot envelope to count. And then county election officials under state law were required to verify every signature. They did that by matching them against signatures on files. And it's important to note that the California Secretary of State's office rejected this claim, and they even posted their own fact check on Twitter. And one more point to clarify, county election officials, they use the same verification process that I just mentioned to check signatures on recall petitions and referendums and statewide initiatives. So there's really no difference here.
Okay, you pointed to one more piece of evidence in the fact check dealing with rejected ballots. How do those rejected ballots factor in?
Well, for this fact check, we contacted Kim Alexander. She's president of the California Voter Foundation. And she pointed out to us that nearly 50,000 vote-by-mail ballots were rejected in November because the signatures did not sufficiently match the ones on voter registration forms. So Alexander described that as clear evidence that this verification process is in effect.
Okay, so it's working. How did you then end up rating Sorbo's claim on Twitter?
Well, we saw this as an extreme falsehood, again, given all the information that was out there, all the evidence that we just talked about. So we gave it our most severe rating, pants on fire.
Chris, I want to talk about one more fact check you did. You fact checked some of the statements made about Vice President, you know, former California Senator Kamala Harris during last week's impeachment trial. Tell us what you found.
Well, during the trial, defense attorneys for former President Trump, they argued that Harris and other Democrats, they also used incendiary rhetoric in their speeches. They said their language was no different from that used by Trump on January 6th, right before some of his most extreme supporters marched to the Capitol and took over the building. Defense attorney Michael Vanderveen made this claim in reference to Harris's support for the George Floyd protests last year.
She said of the violent demonstrations, "Everyone beware. They're not going to stop before Election Day in November, and they're not going to stop after Election Day. They're not going to let up, and they should not."
And that was in reference to protests following the death of George Floyd. Did he get that right?
Well, he got some of that right, but he also took a lot of it really out of context. He's referring to an interview Harris did with Stephen Colbert last June, where she said the protest movement would continue. Mm-hmm. She did use the phrase, "everyone beware," so he got that right. But when you listen to the full exchange, she's not talking about supporting riots or violent demonstrations, as Vanderveen claims. Here she is on Colbert.
"This is a movement, I'm telling you. They're not going to stop. And everyone beware, because they're not going to stop. They're not going to stop before Election Day in November, and they're not going to stop after Election Day."
Chris, how did PolitiFact rate this claim?
Well, this claim is very similar to other distortions of what Harris has said in the past, and PolitiFact rated this false.
That's Cap Radio's PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thanks, Nicole.
And you can find all of our fact checks at politifact.com/California and at capradio.org. Still ahead, we bid a fun farewell to one of our colleagues, Ezra David Romero. Shoot us an email to insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi, Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon. This show is usually a place for conversations about what is happening in our community. And today, that includes some news in our Cap Radio community. Joining us now is Ezra David Romero, Cap Radio's environment reporter and host of the Tahoe Land podcast. And the news is that after more than 3 years of serving our community as an award-winning reporter, he is making some big career moves, so we are taking a few minutes to celebrate Ezra and look back at some of his most memorable projects. Also joining us are Cap Radio podcast director Sally Schilling and data reporter Emily Zentner. Ezra, everyone, welcome.
Hi, Nicole. Hey, thanks.
Well, this is just one big farewell party, so Ezra, what is this bittersweet news? Where are you headed to next?
Thanks, Nicole. After 3.5 years or so, I'm going to KQED. That's the NPR station in San Francisco, the Bay Area. I'll be covering climate change. I'll be part of a team of science reporters. And it's a great next step for me.
Yeah, it is. But we will miss you so much.
Same. I'll miss Cap Radio a lot.
Ezra, you came to Cap Radio in the fall of 2017 as an environment reporter from Valley Public Radio in the Central Valley. So much has happened in those 3 years. You have covered California's historic wildfires, continued drought cycles. You also became a beloved podcast host. First, you did Yosemite Land. Okay, this podcast looked at the impacts of tourism in the iconic national park. What inspired this series?
Well, I had covered Yosemite National Park for 5 years in Fresno, was in our coverage area, and Yosemite's also in Cap Radio's coverage area. So when I moved to Sacramento, we wanted to do a podcast, and I had already had this history with the place. So we decided, let's work on this thing. And the whole idea was to talk about how people are changing this place, whether it's climate change, whether it's bears, whether it's Starbucks in the park.
Well, in your podcast, you spend a lot of time with folks you were interviewing, you know, including really getting to know some Native American elders from Yosemite to learn about their long history in that region, you know, longtime rock climbers in the park. And then came the Tahoe Land podcast and a series on how climate change could transform that whole area. Here's that intro.
There's this moment when you drive over the ridge and the pristine blue water of Lake Tahoe comes into view. Every time I see it, it blows me away.
Looks like we're moving.
On this trip to Tahoe, I took the route on Highway 50 over Echo Pass. It's on the south side of the lake.
There's about 30 or 40 cars just waiting to go down the hill and probably the same or more going up.
The last time I drove this route was a few months ago. It was winter then, but there wasn't any snow. Come to think of it, I haven't seen snow here in a decade. The year is 2099.
Ezra, you made people envision a potentially grim scene at Lake Tahoe in the future. What made you want to do a whole podcast about something as dark and scary as climate change?
Well, it's the story of our time. I mean, I just felt like we have to start reporting on this in a deeper way because it's what's happening in the world. Like at that point, I had been covering the effects of climate change on people for six to seven years with drought and wildfire, heat islands, all sorts of things. And so we wanted to talk about a beloved place, you know, that people love and sort of like talk to all the scientists, talk to all the people, do all the things and put it into one podcast and sort of to demystify the ethereal climate changeness of it all and talk about, you know, what are the real impacts to human life and to animals and to the iconic places we love.
Yeah, that's one of the thing one of the things I really love about your stories and the way you report them is that climate change seems like this huge scary thing, but you really dig into the everydayness of it. And, you know, just an example of that, one of the cool things that we learn about in the Tahoe Land podcast is that one thing a lot of people might not know is that there are a ton of invasive shrimp in Lake Tahoe. Emily Zentner, I want to bring you in here because you went on an adventure with Ezra to learn more about this. You went on a boat ride on the lake in the middle of the night. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Ezra and I had some wild times with those shrimp. We took a boat with some UC Davis researchers out onto Lake Tahoe in the middle of the night, and they're trying to see if it would be possible for them to remove these trillions of tiny shrimp that are invading the lake. And one of my favorite things about working with Ezra the past few years has been that we're both giant nerds, so we both were like, tiny shrimp in the lake, we have to know more, we have to find out more about this. And on top of learning about all of the really interesting science behind the shrimp issue, Ezra and Sally and I had one big question, which was whether or not the shrimp were edible. And so Ezra and I did a little taste test while we were on the boat. They're not good. You don't want to eat them. So, yeah, it did not go well for us.
Who's going to put the shrimp on the crab?
Honestly, it doesn't taste like anything.
They feel like something, though.
You're right. They're not good.
You're right. I don't like it.
You're right.
You guys are so brave. I would not have done that.
I don't know why we ate them. They were alive.
Like, it was a mistake.
Well, if it was the middle of the night, I think maybe we can blame it on that.
Yeah, it was like 2 a.m.
We also have to mention, though, that you two won an Edward R. Murrow Award, prestigious award for that project. So congratulations. The Tahoe Land podcast focuses a lot on the clarity of the lake, which led you to follow some researchers to other alpine lakes. Sally, you worked on this with Ezra. What do you think made this such a successful podcast?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of things, but, you know, that nerding out that Emily was talking about was a big thing.
Okay, so you've also been a key reporter, Ezra. You know, it hasn't all been climate and environment. You've reported on social justice movements, which we've seen here in Sacramento. Not too long after you got here, Sacramento police shot and killed Stephon Clark in March 2018. That led to protests throughout the city. I want to play a little bit of tape here of you asking a young woman a really powerful question after one of the first vigils held for Stephon Clark.
Was this a surprise at all?
No. We live in America. Like, this is what happens in America. And I think a lot of people are so shocked that Sacramento, that it's happening in Sacramento, or that it has happened in Sacramento. It's been happening in Sacramento. It's been happening everywhere. And unfortunately, as one of the most diverse cities in this nation, we still have tons and tons and tons of racism to deal with, as everywhere. Racism is the framework and the very foundation of this nation, and I am never surprised when things like this happen. I'm disappointed, I'm angry, I'm scared, but I'm not surprised.
That is shocking to hear. That was 3 years ago almost. It sounds, you know, just like it could have been yesterday. Ezra, I don't know if you remember this moment, and you can tell us a little bit about it.
Well, that's one moment of many moments that are all the same, unfortunately, right? Like, that's why the feeling of that moment feels this like the same moment we could have today. It's that it's a cultural problem. It's a larger issue that hasn't changed, right? It's since slavery. It's we're here, right? Like, there's been, like, Black people have been, you know, harmed for a long time, and so that woman's answer was just an overflow of all this history that her and her ancestors have been through. So working on the protest side of things, you know, like marching all night, we walked on the freeway, we did all these kind of things. It actually just really broke me in the past couple of years. You know, I'm a person of color and I'm not Black, but I'm a Latino, and going out there and being out at these rallies and doing these things, but as a reporter watching, you know, and knowing some of the people and just seeing the pain people have gone through and like the overflow of it, you know, just sort of like wore me down a bit in a good way. It like made me more sensitive, and it allowed me to ask questions like this and just talk to people about what's going on in their lives. And I think that's why I asked the question in a simple way, like, you know, is this a surprise? And they're like, no, because this is something we've gone through for forever.
Mm-hmm. Is that something you learned, you know, several years ago that you were able to bring to reporting over social justice, racial justice protests now?
I guess so. I mean, I just try to talk to people like they're people. Like every time I talk to them, whether they're a scientist or whether they're a person who's out on the street, you just, you know, they're humans. And like, that's the power of reporting, is like, you're going to talk to people and hear their stories, and they're never going to get old because each story is individual and, you know, in their lives are important. And so I think that's why Kaya is, her story is important, or like the Tahoe land scientist up in Nevada is important as well. Like, they're doing work to change the world in different spaces, and I think that's important to capture.
It's important work, but how do you feel, Ezra, about covering these racial justice movements and the impacts of climate change? I mean, my question is, do you ever feel like you're just telling the same stories over and over and over?
I mean, I think the larger story is the same story in both of these scenarios over and over again, right? Climate change is happening. We're polluting the world. We're, you know, we're putting carbon into the air, and then all these effects are happening on the racial justice side. This is a systematic problem that's happened for hundreds of years, and this is the overflow over it. So that's, maybe it gets old to tell that same story over and over, but it doesn't get old to talk about the effects of either on people's lives and on the world we live in. Those stories are always changing, and that's like, the joy is sort of in the details, we can call any of that joy.
Mm-hmm. That was my next question, is what motivates you to keep doing this work and telling these kinds of stories every day?
Well, like I said earlier, I think both of these kinds of stories, whether it's racial justice or climate change, both stories are the stories of our time. You know, there are things that are changing in the world. And I think for me to not be reporting on those things, I don't know what I would be reporting on. I just think that's what we have to report on, because that's what's happening in the world. And both of those things, whether if they're not dealt with in some way, will harm people's lives for the foreseeable future.
Ezra, we've talked about your two successful, really great podcasts. I want to hear a little bit more about some of your favorite stories you've done here at Cap Radio over the years. Are there any that stick out?
Yeah, I mean, I loved working on the Tahoe Land podcast. That's probably like my magnus opus, right? Like, what I really love to do is like the best thing. But I think recently, this past year, I worked on a lot of stories about the history of wildfires in California, whether it's why we suppress fires. And I think during that process, you know, there's been about 100 years of suppressing forests. And in that process, I realized, hey, this goes back further. And it goes back further to like when people in America, you know, like killed Native Americans. There was a genocide of Native Americans. They took them off the land. And that's sort of when this fire suppression started happening. And so I think I really loved going deeper into the fire issues in California and talking about the social constructs that equal the fires we have today. I think that's really interesting to talk about. Tons of other stories. I mean, I really liked working on the racial justice stuff. It took me out of my box, and we talked about environmental justice. We talk about what area of town or what area of the state you live in and how your life could be so different, you know, just streets over from another neighborhood. There's just so many stories. I can't remember them all.
Well, we have loved having you in the newsroom here at Cap Radio, Ezra. We cannot wait to see what you do next.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, there's one more thing we want to play. We have a clip of you learning to ski with Olympic skier and Tahoe native Maddie Bowman. So we just have to play this.
The most embarrassing.
Leg. Woo! Link and turn. Good job. Left leg.
Ah!
Nice, good thing.
I almost died.
Oh, Ezra, that's fun.
Yeah, we were learning to ski for the Tahoe Land podcast to talk about how snow levels are changing because of climate change. And you heard me scream, so that's how I'll go out.
He'll always do it for a reason.
Yeah.
Cap Radio environment reporter Ezra David Romero, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We also had data reporter Emily Zentner and podcast director Sally Schilling. And that is Insight for today. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can follow Ezra on Twitter at Ezra Romero, I think. Keep in touch with him. Thanks to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Technical director is Mark Jones, and engineer is Antonio Muniz. I'm Nicole Nixon in for Randall White. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.